Hello and welcome to another episode of the Creative Weirdos Podcast. Thank you for hanging around. Sorry it's been a minute since I've had a new episode. Life has been busy between holidays, birthday, sickness, wildly busy time at work in the best way, between both my normal illustration gig with the coffee company and my freelance and personal work. It's just been very hectic, and I've been working on this new series of podcasts that I really wanted to put some extra time into, and this is the first episode or installment of that series, and it's all about weird comics. If you've been listening for a while, you know that I'm kind of a little bit fascinated with the strangeness that surrounds fictions and different works of fiction, especially that in the sequential artwork, and I really wanted to kind of drill down on some of this. So I am asking back some past guests and good friends and some new friends and weirdos and a whole bunch of people I never thought I'd get a chance to talk to come on and kind of share their love and interest in comics and where it might get a little weird. So to kick this whole thing off, I have my good friend Super Inframan coming back to talk about a person and creator that's very important to his world, Jack Kirby. We cover a ton of Kirby's career, what he means to Super Inframan, his mystical tendencies, and how he is a beautiful example of someone that tapped into something that is available to all of us if we perform these creative acts correctly or something along those lines. I don't know. We get into a bunch of weird stuff that's just my favorite topic to talk about. So without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Super Inframan about the King Jack Kirby, and I'll be talking to you soon with more comic weirdness. Have a great day. Bye. I know on previous episodes we've talked about your personal connection to Kirby a little bit, and like a little bit, and I definitely want to get into some of those conversations to start
with. Sure.
But I figured a good place to kind of start this convo is when did you fall in love with Kirby? Like, when did you really start? What was the story? I feel like everybody has the story where they're like, oh, I get Kirby now. And I was wondering if there's one that did it for you, or how that worked for you.
You know, so it's multi-layered. It was definitely things like, you know, Fantastic Four with the Silver Surfer and Galactus, and then trying to understand, like, you know, I love Thor. I always liked how Thor had this sort of like good natured jolliness and sort of, you know, braggadocio that was like friendly and inviting and, you know, want to give everybody a hug and walk the old lady down the street and all these things. But how these guys were like gods, but they were something different too. And
yeah,
you start to see where, you know, there are these little abstractions that come in. But it was definitely with those like early Marvel books. You know, my brother had them around. I had a cousin that was about the same age as my brother, about 10 years older than I am, and, you know, gave me a huge stack of Thor, starting back with before it was, you know, it was still Journey into Mystery, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Going through like almost all of Kirby's early run on the book, and you've got like Tales of Asgard and some of those and these things. And so I'm sitting here trying to like make sense of like, okay, these are mythological characters, but they're alive. But then there's other cosmologies around too, mm-hmm. You know? And so none of this fits in like neat boxes. And so I love that. And then here's where the side tangent comes in. You know, all of us, I think, wanted to be comic book artists when we were kids. And some of us, pursued to fulfill the dream like you have, Todd. And it's one of the reasons I love you so much, because you're so, you know, abundantly joyous in your focus and dedication to, you know, your panels and the heart and creativity you put in them. I started trying to draw what I thought mythological figure should look like for society or whatever. And this is when I'm like 11 and 12 and 13 and didn't quite know what I was doing, but I was like, okay, this guy in this business suit with, sickle and all of these things is going to be my trickster god, blah, blah, blah. And, started trying to make these pantheons. And I didn't really realize where that was coming from until I probably got to college and went back to Kirby again.
Oh, and, so cool.
And we this is about the time, we've got the internet now, and so you and I are getting to hear bits of Grant Morrison talking about Kirby, bits of Alan Moore talking about Kirby, and these guys that understood all of these layers that he was mixing in that, we probably understood on a level we didn't articulate, but now here were people giving voice to it. And I was like, oh God, I've got to go back and read this stuff. And so that was when my, the child innocent love was there, but now there's this adult intellectual literary, whatever, fascination with the cosmos came back in.
That's beautiful. And that's it tracks a lot. I came to it way later in life. I came to comics in general later in life. I loved comic strips growing up. I grew up on Calvin and Hobbes and Peanuts and things like that more than any. I had brief phases where I'd buy some superhero comics in the 90s. I was a kid in the 90s, but it never really hit for me. I kind of didn't really get into it until I was in a junior in high school and I was looking for a new group of friends. I had decided I wanted to do art for a living, and I knew there was underground comics. I had been in at punk shows. I'd had zines with people making their own comics and stuff like that, but it didn't really click until I started hanging out with this group of kids that made their own comics. And they were the first people to they were this beautiful mix of people that went to the shop every Wednesday and would buy the newest Marvel stuff. At that time, the Ultimate Universe was just coming out, and Bagley was writing every book, and it was that early 2000s era, right? But at the same time, Marvel was putting out these weird books where Peter Bagg would do a Spider-Man run, or Jim Mahfood would come in and do a random Spider-Man stories. And so they took me to the shop on Wednesday and introduced me to the mainstream comics, but at the same time they were putting Daniel Clowes and they were putting Love and Rockets and all the independent stuff. And then because of the way that I got into music, and the first thing I did when I started listening to Green Day was well, where did this come from? And then you go back to the early 80s hardcore, and then you go back to the Ramones, and then you go back to the Velvet Underground and the garage bands, and then you go back to early, roots rock and roll in America. And I wanted to do the same thing with comic art. And then you land at Kirby's feet and you realize, we were just talking about before, that Kirby was at the beginning of this whole thing that we call comic books. Comic strips had existed for a while, and I think he dabbled in very few amount of comic strips, but once comic books were being comics were being packaged as books, he was kind of there from the beginning. And he defined things like adventure comics, which were a giant genre for a long time that people don't really identify Kirby with. And he did all the genre work, westerns, horrors. He invented romance comics and all. He had this whole career before that Marvel. One of the things I love, people that have late in life success, I love that the Ramones didn't record their first record until most of them were 30, right? That gives you a lot of hope, when you're a young kid being shit, how do you and then when you find out that Kirby had two careers before he did the Fantastic Four and stuff, I think he was 40 something or maybe older when he did Fantastic Four, right? It's super interesting to me how we come to these. But at that point, once you got to college and got the internet and everything, did you start going back? And at what point did you kind of discover the historical Kirby stuff? Was it something that you got right into, or?
No, it wasn't. I got more into his cosmology a little bit more because I started to make the connections between, a lot of magical thought and creative thought and the things that Kirby was doing in comics. The more historical aspect of it, I want to say it was probably somebody pointing out to me Captain America, you know, the first issue's cover, where you've got, you know, the perfect Aryan in, you know, Steve Rogers. He's made into that figure.
Absolutely.
Punching Hitler. And, you know, this is before we're in World War II.
Yep.
You know, I think it's 6 or 8 months ahead of time. So, you know, it's, there were still some people that liked Hitler in the United States at this point. I mean, this was a thing.
That's a weird thing to think about, but it's true.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to remember, too, with the Holocaust, news was not in real time, right?
Yeah.
And so you've got Jewish families, immigrants, families of immigrant families, children of immigrant families mm-hmm. that are getting letters from, you know, Europe that are like, hey, things are scary over here. Weird stuff's happening. We're afraid. We're, you know, fleeing to different areas. But this really isn't like all over the news. We didn't know about internment camps really until after the war was over when we were going to liberate these things, how bad yeah. it was. And so the fact that you've got, you know, Joe Simon, who was a Jewish immigrant, and then Jack Kirby, who was the children of immigrants, very connected to his Jewish heritage growing up in the Lower East Side. You know, it was very intentional that they were like, we're going to yeah. take a guy that looks like their hero and have him kick their butts.
Yes.
You know, like it was, you know, this was premeditated. And if you knew, you knew. But if you didn't know, it was a fun story.
And they were making the meme, like they were leading the culture, like whether they thought about it that way or not, there was some sort of inner or outer acknowledgement that if they put this in this comic book, it's going to manifest, and this person's going to be stopped in some way. You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
I really
yeah.
like not saying that it's that grandiose that they, you know. Before World War, but it's there. Like, it really is cool. It's there. And the fact that they both served, and I think Simon served, right? Did they both? I know Kirby served, obviously.
Kirby did. You know what? I'm not sure on Simon.
Maybe Simon, maybe he stayed. I can't remember.
He may have been stateside.
Yeah, I was just going to say, maybe he was stateside. And a lot of these dudes ended up drawing comics. They got out of actual, like Kirby saw real time. Like, he killed people. He did the whole thing. And, like, the few interviews where you can hear him talk about it, he almost mm-hmm. sounds like a different person when he gets into those stories. It's wild to hear, actually.
Yeah.
It's a little jarring because usually he's a charmer somewhat. And, like, that's something I want to talk to you about in a little bit, actually, as far as Kirby's okay. interviews and his personality outside of the comic the drawing table. But before we leave historic, like this time period, I think there is something to be said about when he went to war and when he came back. Like, I think, like, obviously that trauma of having to, you know, serve in that way and like face those things is going to change you no matter what. And I think that whole generation of comics artists, Will Eisner, Jack Kirby, like all these guys that came back from war, their comics changed. Like, they 100% like Eisner's one of my favorite examples, where if you look at the Spirit before he went to the war, it's yeah. pretty good and it's pretty standard. But those, like, what we think of as the Spirit with those giant splash pages and those really beautiful narrative layouts and really pushing the form, that's all after war. That's all he came back from. Mm-hmm. And I think these people are like processing trauma in a certain way. And I don't know. I kind of want to get your thought on that time period of Kirby's life and how that impacted his work.
And this, you know, and I'll point people, if they can find this, it may be hard to find. Glenn Fleming did some interviews with Jack Kirby in person and made a little documentary about it, but I think it may only be available in the UK.
Okay.
But might be worth checking out. But Glenn was sitting at the kitchen table at Jack's house in California while Jack is talking about some of his experiences in the war. And it absolutely, you know, traumatized him in different ways. You can kind of hear some of their gravitas coming through and the weight and the pain. But, you know, Jack also is tempered in how he relates this. He doesn't let it, like, ruin his day. But you also can kind of see where, when he would talk about his characters later, as he got more back into superhero comics in the 60s and then getting to things that, you know, we know with the New Gods and Eternals and everything like that. He was, to borrow a Stan Lee term, a true believer, in the sense of he wanted and believed in the idea of the superhero or the person as being incapable of being more or being something better. And I think that was him sort of being aspirational after his experiences in the war, because I really do think that the war influenced everything that he produced after that. Dark Side is based off of Nixon and Hitler. I mean, it's very direct in there. And, you know, I mean, even the, like the terms he uses for his, Dark Side's henchmen and things are, you know, they're German,
yeah.
You know, and they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like this is, yeah.
It's there. You know, no, absolutely.
It's absolutely. All in there. But I like that. And this is one of the reasons I love the Forever People. And the Forever People, for listeners that aren't as familiar, were sort of children of the new gods that came to Earth to save a friend. And they're very like reflective of the hippie movement and like new age. Their names are like Beautiful Dreamer and Mark Moonrider and, you know, Big Bear, all these like very fun names. And they look like space hippies. And I mean yep. that in the, you know, most positive, endearing way possible. But what's fascinating about him is they're in costume, but it's an exaggerated, like almost like super ego version of a person, as opposed to, you know, wearing a Superman or a Spider-Man or yes. whatever costume. So you're blurring the line between the traditional superhero with a secret identity with this sort of like super actualized, mm-hmm. you know, individual that's like, I'm trying to think, living out like Samsara, where they're total full selves.
Absolutely. And
the world moving around them, you know?
Yeah, no.
And I'm very fascinated how he arrived at that. I haven't quite put it all together, but I think, you know, there was a very strong thing behind Kirby to like have these people express their authenticity, you know, and show these characters off from Supertown that yes. came to Earth through a portal, you know. It's I don't know, Todd, I apologize, I'm running very far with this, but I keep going. It goes back to, you know, you're putting the meme out there, you know, the first yeah. meme with Captain America of like, we've got to stop this guy somehow, we've got to right the ship. And then, you know, you're going through you've got this turmoil of the civil rights movement and all these things that are, you know, people asking for us to live up to what we said during the war yeah. about humanity. And suddenly you've got something like the Forever People that are, you know, aspirational of like, here's what we could be, you know, here is the actualized selves that are, you know, have no insecurities and are not self-conscious. And when people see them, they realize that there's something different about them because they are these super actualized, you know, individuals that happen to look like, you know, gallivanting teenagers.
Totally. I think that you're so right. And I mean, it's expressed, if nothing else, in the fact that those were comics where he explicitly was like, these are nonviolent comics. Like there are yeah. some like fights and stuff in there, but like mm-hmm. he really tries to avert conflict. Like when there is, it's usually like somebody trips and accidentally hits, you know, it's always like a fumble yeah. or something. Like it's never a direct, like he tries to embrace this nonviolent. Again, I think like you're saying, it's that reaction to war and that putting out that ideal of what he saw people could be, or the superhumanity that lives in yes. everybody, right? Like I think there's really something there. And I think there's so much that I want to get into with Forever People and the New Gods with you. But before we get there, I want to go back to his Marvel time for a second, okay. because something that like really fascinates me, and what somebody we were talking about before we started recording, Tom Scioli talks about this a lot in a really cool way, is that if you look at comics from the beginning, they have this horror element imbued in them. Whether you look at it from Spider-Man, who's this mm-hmm. mutation of a very, you know, a Halloween type image of a spider, you know, and has this creepy mask and everything, to things like the Hulk, that's just like a giant monster, or the Thing. Mm-hmm. And like, there's these elements of horror that live in there. And I think Kirby is, and you know, Tom talks about this, that Kirby is a big part of that because he comes from the genre comics of doing like horror comics, and he loves horror and he loves sci-fi. He loved the pulps growing up. So he's putting that in there. And then like Stan Lee's just kind of responding and dancing on top of it and doing what he, you know, doing what he does to make right. it all work. But I love that, like, when comics really took over for the second time, you know, you have the first big boom with Superman, where it became this cultural phenomenon, sold millions mm-hmm. and millions of copies. And then those Marvel issues of like the Fantastic Four and stuff, that's like the second big boom where everybody culturally gets back into it. And Kirby's inserting this element of horror and kind of sci-fi pulpiness right from the beginnings that I don't think would be there without him.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, and I feel like we've lost a little of that. And I think we might get some of it back. Maybe we'll see.
Yeah, I'd like that.
What's wonderful about, you know, if you go read some of his horror comics from beforehand, you know, there's a lot of like monkey's paw type stories and mm-hmm. things like that. Like there's a one where there's this guy in the old West that discovers Thor's hammer. It's actually a DC book. I can't remember which specific title it was in, but he goes around and like, goes to places that are having droughts and like kind of cons them into like paying them a lot of money to make it rain and all these things. And eventually like Thor, if I remember right, kills the guy at the end of the book, you know, because he's, you know, abused the power or yeah. something like that. And I may have that a little wrong, but it's worth seeking out because even the way the hammer is drawn looks just the way that he would draw it at Marvel later.
That's so cool.
You know, you've got stuff like that. The Incredible Hulk could have easily been one of the horror comics he was doing at Marvel before the superhero boom. I mean, totally. You just need to have like a little bit of like a dark ending on those first issue or two. And like, it's straight up that, but you know, that's why I like that element and why I kind of hope it comes back some. And I think we might see it come back some, because when you're dealing with monsters, whatever they are, or villains and these things, like, they probably should feel horrific.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I truly agree. Like, you know, let's take Friday the 13th with Jason, you know, who is this sort of unstoppable force that just keeps pursuing you. Mm-hmm. Then you insert somebody that's got some kind of superpower or whatever.
Absolutely.
And, you know, is trying to leverage that in some way to stop this thing.
Yeah.
That's a pretty straightforward superhero story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you know, you actually have a villain that's terrifying and even your hero is like terrified.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. So a lot of horror movies to me, by the way, sorry, Todd, I'm cutting you off.
No, keep going. Keep going.
You know, they're kind of superhero stories. There's just somebody not in a costume, you know,
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those are the things I like. I love that. I love
me
that.
Me too. And I think they filled that gap in like the late 70s to early 80s before there was superhero movies like the Batmans and stuff like that. Like you had the slashers and like those guys, that was superhero movies. It really was comic movies. Like, and even, whoa, I just almost fell out of my chair. That's really funny. Even like, you know, things like Blade, which was, I think, one of the first, you know, comic book, like big comic book movies. It's all yeah. vampire slaying and stuff that, you know, people, I didn't even know it was a comic book movie until like, you know, 7 years after it came out. Yeah. Like, same thing with The Crow. Like I watched The Crow growing up a million times before knowing that right. was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I spent my whole life loving, like, that was my jam. You know, I was born in 1985. So by the time like I was six, they were a firmly established thing, but the comics were not there. Like it was everything else, but the comics were not there until way later. And I found out that it was a, you know, black and white self-published phenomenon and like all of that. That's a beautiful story, but yeah, no, I think you're dead on. And you know, the one other thing that I wanted to touch on with you in this time period that we don't have to dwell on too much, but I do think is like it relates to a lot of what we've been talking about already and a lot of what kind of gets talked about in whether it's esoteric magic circles or paranormal circles, and that's this like this thing that's being created in a very liminal situation that has a lot of traumatic pressure to it. Because I mean, Kirby, and he's making some of the best work of his life during this period in mm-hmm. Fantastic Four and everything, and it's changing the culture, it's having this giant success, but he's not really reaping the rewards at all. And he's not only not reaping the rewards, he's actually being actively fucked over during this whole thing.
Right.
And like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that is very gray area as far as who came up with what in the Marvel universe and who gets credit for what. And we don't have to go down the whole Stan Lee division, but there was a, obviously when he left, he placed a lot of funny things in his new DC works that were making, what was it? Funky Flashman. Is that,
The
character that is representing Stan Lee. So obviously it was a very traumatic experience for him, like going through everything he went through at Marvel, creating what he created, and then essentially being patted on the head and given a very small stipend and told like, good work, do more. And, you know, I think that's there's a lot more that can be said, but I think that those situations that have that kind of it's that paradox where, you know, it had to have that negative element for him to create that next chapter. Like what he makes next is directly in response to going through that. And he gets fucked over in a whole other way through the next part that we can get into. But there's something to the fact that there's this really weird tension in this creation. I think about it like the Ramones a lot. The Ramones fucking hated each other, and the best shows they ever played were when all four of them absolutely hated each other on that stage right then. And like, there's something magic to working with somebody you hate in a weird way. And is represented so beautifully in Kirby and Stan Lee. And I, you know, the one thing I wanted to ask you about is, there's a lot of ways where it seems like Stan wrote the narrative around their relationship, because when people would go to Kirby and Stan Lee, whether it was like Rolling Stone or New York Times, and they'd interview them, Stan Lee was just a smoother talker. He was better to soundbite. He, you know, like from the beginning, Kirby was kind of known as a little bit of a mumbler, and like he would kind of ramble and like be kind of hard to follow in certain and not answer questions directly and kind of dance around things and do a lot of his cosmic jumble talk and all of that. And like, so I think that he didn't really get to write his own story. And then when he starts getting the response later in life, and people are coming to his aid to get his artwork back and all that stuff, and he's given a platform, people are like, oh, he's not as easily express, or he can't easily express himself like a Stan Lee, or, and like, it's just, he's not like that kind of person that's really smooth talking and everything. And like, I think that is super interesting, because he almost is so into the worlds that he's creating, he can't do both. You know what I mean? Like, you can't expect somebody to like put so much on the board and like be constantly not only creating as far as like physical drawing and drafting, but this dude is creating character after character, world after world, and then like visual language. Like, he's literally creating languages that didn't exist like before him, ink marks and like all of these things that didn't exist before what he's doing, you know? So I don't think he can be faulted for not also having like the elevator pitch down or the sound, you know what I mean? Like, but have you come across that in your like listening to him talk in the little bits and stuff like that?
For sure. You know, and because when Jack talks, he sounds like your elderly grandfather, you know, simplifying things to tell you about it. I mean, so, but then you'll hear him like, you know, rattle off something about the source and how, you know, he believes the source is a real thing. And you're like, what? You know, I mean, it's like getting hit with a car of like gnosis or something.
Yes, dude. And I think that's part of the problem is someone like, so like I was telling you, I was listening to that interview with, Gary Groth from Fantagraphics, who's like one of my favorite interviewers, but he's not as good at dealing with the weird mumbo jumbo. Like, I feel like if Jack Kirby could have been interviewed by like Jeff Kreipl or something, there would have been a whole other way of like talking about that. Right. You know what I mean? Like the people that were interviewing him were comics based. And like, even when I like think of somebody like Tom or like a lot of these people that are current comics dudes, like that are more into some of the weirder stuff, they still, there's a line. Their boggle threshold is not as open to some of this stuff, you know? And like, it would have been interesting to see somebody like Jack Kirby be interviewed by somebody that is like more invested in the stranger side of things and whatnot. Yeah.
Oh, you know, that might be my greatest what if that could have happened, right? If you had somebody like, you know, Dr. Kripal interviewing Jack Kirby, you know, in 1990 or something like that. I mean, totally. I can't even imagine what that would be like.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so and Jack, like, and I even heard this in another interview today. I may have been from one that Kirby Dynamics had uploaded or maybe from the Jack Kirby Museum. But they were just asking him about all of this in different ways. And he goes, you know, I never wanted to be Picasso. I never wanted to be this artist or that artist. I just wanted to be Jack Kirby telling a fun story, an entertaining story, a good story, you know, like that, that was it. And so, you know, you listen to that and today we would have said, man, he would have like really benefited if he had had an agent to advocate for him and handle, you know, that sort of thing. And I know Roz did her best. You know, his wife is to protect him and kind of handle that. But I think, you know, he just wanted to be at his board drawing and telling those stories. I think just given the massive amount of art he produced in his career, because I think he would, I think he produced about 6 pages a day on average. And if you think he was drawing from like the mid 30s to, I think he passed away in 96, it's either 94 or 96. I've been hitting the head a lot, guys. But anyway, you know, the utter magnitude is just like, what?
It's insane.
You know, and so, you know, I felt like he probably could not hold that back. And so you had to have these other people out there. And I think that's one of the reasons that when you get, you know, Kirby and Lee together, you get, you know, Fantastic Four, you get the X-Men. Because suddenly you've got somebody that's like directing that towards you. And, you know, I always characterize Stan Lee as like the ultimate hype man.
Yes.
And he kind of is, you know, and I wouldn't compare him to somebody like, you know, you and I like, is it Rick Rubin, right?
Yeah, totally.
But there's a certain element of that to it too, where he's not producing Kirby, but he is getting Kirby's work to the correct audience, which is one of those things that I always love about, you know, Ruben talking about, like, we think about the audience after we've made this, you know, the art, you know, we don't think about the audience before we make the art. And so you've got Lee, who's this, you know, incredible soft skills. He can speak, he's eloquent. He's this hype man or a carnival barker or whatever. That is like out here saying, hey, look at this, you know, true believer. You won't believe what happens in these pages, yada, yada, yada. You know, totally. When you turn the page, your life will change. and it's Jack on the inside, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that combination is like so much more of the sum of its parts.
Absolutely.
And I don't say that to take away from Jack, because I have a hard time even deciding what of his work I like more, you know, his post Marvel stuff when he's doing the New Gods, like that's certainly the stuff that I dig into the most.
Yeah.
But you know, when I want to share with somebody the joy of comics,
yes,
you know, I'm going to go find like, you know, the issues that Galactus shows up or something
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely.
You know,
or,
and Go ahead, Todd.
No, I was going to say you're absolutely right. And it's all about like knowing your audience when you're sharing comics. That's such a good point, because like there's a lot of people that you would put any of those New Gods or Forever People books, like one of those in their hands, and they'd be like, nope, I have no clue what's going on here. There's a bunch of reasons that people can get turned off by that. But if you put a Marvel book from that time that is Kirby and Lee, like they're going to get it. They're going to eat it up. Like, especially if it's a kid, like those books are made, they really are made for like 12 to 16 year old kids.
Yeah.
Like they really like, it's perfect material for that stuff. And one of the things that like, I think Stan Lee and Kirby just have it's a beautiful way to look at how different intentions get you to where you are. Right. Because I don't think Stan Lee ever really wanted to be like a full-time storyteller author. Like he wanted to be a moneymaker move. Like he, you know, he wanted to be famous. He wanted to be in the spotlight more, where Kirby really did just want to make things. Like he's a creator. He is 100%. And like the way that the way that the stuff that he went through changed things for creators in the long run has, mm-hmm. you know, effects that I don't think he could have ever thought about or ever really have any intention of doing. But I mean, he's yeah. the stuff that he went through has changed the way that not only the industry works, but like the way that young cartoonists work and the way that yeah. we look at how, I mean, comic artists have been shit on forever. It's wild. Like, it's wild yeah. how this medium that and has how created much
did, like, everybody love it at some point in their lives, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it took over the mass culture for, you know, I think it's waning. I think it is on its way out, it seems, as far as it being like the cultural touchstone. But there was this giant period here where these characters that Kirby was at least directly responsible for the majority of, took over the culture. They came from this place that like was a very, again, like Kirby would say in these interviews, like you, if the people that read comics are the type of people that hang out at pool halls, like they're not the people yeah. that want to be, you know, seen as respectable types, like, you know, so yeah. it came from this like gutter culture and took over the whole thing, like, and it's all it's that part's super fascinating to me. But to kind of get to the point there, to the next part of Kirby's life that I'm like, I'm super excited to go through with you, because I think it's both of our favorites, is the New Gods and the Forever People, and this period where, you know, Kirby has this very dramatic leaving of Marvel, and, you know, there's a lot of issues that goes on there, and he goes to DC being promised a lot, and he goes through a lot of different issues, from, you know, Superman faces being redrawn to being mm-hmm, pulled off mm-hmm. books and like all this stuff. But he gets to create his own universe. He gets to create yeah. the fourth world, that, which I believe he didn't even actually want to use as a title, or I can't, there's one of those yeah. like, was that right? Like DC put that on the books for him, and I don't know, I can't remember, but I still kind of love that word, the fourth world. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that title. But this whole beautiful body of work that I love, I think most of all, if for no other reason than like, it defines what I think of as pure comics. It's one person doing almost yes. everything, from storytelling yes. to art. Like, he's not doing the inking and the lettering, which I think like is a whole other thing, but like, he's doing everything as far as like the scripting, the narration, like he's doing it all. It's all his hand. And mm-hmm. man, I think like he is channeling some wild stuff throughout here. And like, I would love to just kind of, if you want to start with just like, you know, wherever you want, really, like whether you want to start with just kind of your overall thoughts on this period of his work, or what you resonate most with it, or I don't know, wherever you want to go with this here, Super Inframan.
Well, yes, there's this great comment I had heard where I'm trying to remember who the interviewer was in this one, but they were describing Jack Kirby as like micro dosing his audience with like pure creativity. You know,
and I love that.
And the implications of like, you know, psychedelics being like very, very heavy in the way this was said. And then, but if you know, knew anything about Jack, he was, you know, very lovingly the most square person, you know, to ever exist. And I mean, yes. if you see pictures of him, he looks like, you know, Mr. Rogers from Brooklyn. You know, he's got his like, you know, little sweater on with his button down shirt and his khakis. And, you know, as he gets older, you can see like his belt coming higher and higher over his stomach.
Yes.
You know, and he's chomping on a cigar, and he was not a very large man. His stature was, you know, on the smaller side.
No, they touch on that Napoleon complex that he seems to have in a few yes. interviews that I was watching, and apparently he mentions his stature a lot, which is so interesting. I have mm-hmm. I have a few friends that have had those similar things, and it's just like, I'm a very average sized person, so I've never thought about one way or the other, but right, man, right, yeah. like your physical perspective of the world really changes shit. Cause I have some really tall yeah. friends that see things a lot differently, and really short friends, but man, yeah, Jack Kirby yeah. definitely seemed to fall in that much shorter scale of things.
Oh yeah. You know, and he grew up in the Lower East Side. And, by the way, if anybody ever has a chance to like go on any of the tours that the Jack Kirby Museum organizes around his birthday and things like that, you should. I did one a year ago, I guess, with Rand Hoppe, the director of the Jack Kirby Museum.
That's so cool. And
we did a walking tour around the Lower East Side of like where Jack was born, you know, when he first lived, right before they moved. And then like what kind of functioned a bit like a YMCA, I forget the name of it, but like he was like learning judo there when he was in his, you know, kind of early, not quite teens, I guess tweens ages and stuff like that. But, you know, the Lower East Side was a tough place back then. And then I take a little issue with the MCU Captain America, because he originally was supposed to be from the Lower East Side.
Oh,
and
yeah,
the movie changed to Brooklyn. But you're, that's right, because we don't really know what the Lower East Side is like anymore.
Yeah.
And so for the purpose of the movie, like, oh, we'll just have him from Brooklyn, which is fine. But a lot of the little details about Steve Rogers were taken from Jack's life. Life from growing up there, because there's a lot of immigrant communities. You had a lot of Irish immigrants, and it was a tough place. But anyway, you know, you have this guy who, like, you know, almost, like if, you know, the other way I'll describe him is if Mr. Rogers was like mafia adjacent too.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Where
that's perfect.
He's going to tell you to have a wonderful day, look after you, but he's going to chomp on a cigar. And you know that if like the wrong thing happened, he might punch somebody out.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
there's this story he tells about meeting Roz in one interview and how there was a couple dudes like vying for her affection at the time. Uh-huh. And one of them was a piano player. And he said something along the lines of like, you better watch yourself or those fingers might, or it'd be a shame if something happened to those fingers. You should try and go get in the pictures out west or something. And he said the guy got the picture and moved away. And I was like, that sounds, but there's a lot of those in some of those interviews that he talks about, like a lot of black market dealings and just like very shady things where he grew up that like was just a part of life, and like lots of fights and like lots of rooftop jumping and wild things that you can just like picture affecting comics language so much when you hear him talk about those guys, you know?
Well, and I think it's so important too, because it's not like Jack was having these like Carlos Castaneda experiences or anything like that. But then you go look at New Gods and it's like how did this happen?
Right.
You know? like, because it just, you know, it on the surface, it doesn't fit that like this little like happy grandfather that might punch a man that fought in World War II would create this just incredibly like, he called it like something like he was trying to come up with something bigger than mythology for the present world. But, you know, he even described like the Cosmic Cube in an interview where he says something like, you know, the Cosmic Cube is kind of this wish-making device that the Tesseract sort of became in the MCU, but it could bring your ideas into physical reality. And Jack described it as that is made from the ephemeral of the creative forces in my brain.
Yeah.
And he didn't mean that metaphorically. He meant very literally that the Cosmic Cube is made of ephemeral creative, like energy in my brain. Like, you know, that was amazing. It actualized in a way.
Yes, that's amazing.
And then
I love that.
Oh, it's fantastic. And Todd, if I could find all these other interviews, I'll see if I can track them down and send you the links, and maybe you can share them on Patreon or something. But there's a couple of psychedelic music that use these quotes too, and clips from the interviews where he talks about the source and things like that. And the source is kind of like the source of all creativity and knowledge in the universe. And it is the bedrock, the kind of foundation of the New Gods. And so everybody's trying to gain access to the source and all of these other things and channel it. And in interviews, Jack will go, well, I think the source is a real thing. It's where all ideas come from. And he'll start talking about this stuff in a way that you're like, is this Alan Watts? And, you know, like, and this is before, you know, like,
all of it.
You've been exposed to these people.
No, yeah. And it's so perfect, man. You know, I think my only explanation, and not that it is an explanation, but it's that time he spent at the drawing table. Like, it goes back to my theory that creativity is not the exact same thing as psychedelics or magic or the paranormal, but it's touching the same fabric. And if you're a dude that is spending, you know, 8 hours to 9 hours a day with a pencil and paper in front of you, you're a fucking mystic. You're going to become a mystic. You're going to you're going to tap into some weird stuff. And like, you might never acknowledge it. Like, he might be too Lower East Side to ever be like full on. Like, he might dip into it, but then he'll dip right out and say those things where he's like, I'm just trying to make fun stories for everybody to enjoy, which is true. He's trying to do that, but he's also expressing this beautiful, larger cosmic statement that might be bubbling up unconsciously. Like, all of this stuff, I think, happens a lot. Even when I listen to a lot of more modern day cartoonists that aren't as into the weirder stuff that we're into and such, they'll touch upon things that happen where they'll draw something and have a little precog experience or have a little thing like that, but then they'll be like, oh, they won't give it any credit. They'll be like, that's just that weird shit that happens, and they won't think about it. And like, you know, it's just they won't allow themselves because it's a little too, God, I hate saying woo woo, but it's a little too in that new age area for them to go into. But I think comics have that when you listen to the best comic artists talk, there was this thing that's always been there where it's the self-defeating, self-effacing, they're very they talk down about themselves and they talk down about how important the work that they're doing is. And I think that plays a role in all of this. There's very few cartoonists that I know of that have leaned into it all the way, and those are some of my favorites. But there are, and I mean, there are some kind of Kirby contemporaries that your Barry Windsor Smith's, for example. He had a lot of these experiences and was very open to them and very, very in touch with the cosmic, as they'd say. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really interesting that somebody like you were saying, Kirby, who wouldn't fit the bill as someone who has these cosmic out there experiences, is having them, even though he never touched psychedelics, or his interaction with that counterculture movement was very from afar. You know, it wasn't like he was out there living the hippie life or anything. He was kind of documenting from his drawing table. And you can tell by the way he portrays the culture. You can tell he's not of the culture he's portraying, but it's portraying something bigger. Like he's getting at something. He's tapped into something bigger. And that's why I love when you were talking about the way he portrays Cosmic Dreamer and these characters. It's hard to describe almost the way he makes them their light body show or something. Like, he makes something there's not words for it, you know.
Let me see if I can find this first little just quick paragraph from Forever People number one. It's some of the first little bit of narration dialogue box on the first splash page.
While you pull that up here, oh my God, that is just so gorgeous. Dude, Kirby's issue ones are just the best thing ever.
So here we go. This is actually on the second page, but it's this massive splash page in the top left. It says, the picture of this is this wild motorcycle contraption with four of these figures on it. One of them's flinging this magical box in the air, which is the machine that talks to the source. And the narration box says, "They're from a place that men have sought but never found. We've seen their like before in different ages, in different guise, but never like this. Yet always like this, when men's civilization faces destruction." Yeah, these are teenagers from Supertown, right?
Yes, yes.
And they're this line between mythology and the idea of gods and religion and aliens and magic and all these things that are rolled into one, and they're all of them, and they're not any of them either.
That could be a line out of a Jacques Vallée book. That's the thing. He gets these lines in these, and I love it because the way that Kirby's working, he's not scripting these things out. Like, he is drawing and writing at the same time.
Yes.
So it's not like he's like spending hours coming up with the perfect phrase. Like, he is just, the words are coming to his head. He's writing them on the board and then he's moving to the next pattern. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. These are like bubbling up from somewhere that's very deep, or he's connecting to something that's very deep, or however you want to phrase that. But yeah, he's touching on these ideas that are like, I don't know, like keystones of some of my favorite weirdo thinking and my favorite, like there's these lines where he'll say things that are more unreal than real, or like these twists of phrases that are just like, whoa, like where did that come from? Like, it's so beautiful. It's like people will read these comics and be like, on the surface level, they are superhero stories and like the plots are very plotty and they're very basic. But like, once you get past that and you get past the use of like the word groovy and like things like
yes,
there are these like, it's poetry. It's absolute poetry. It's just like beautiful writing that could, if you even without the pictures, would just be gorgeous and something that would be like a thing to read and think about.
Oh yeah, so let me read this little bit of dialogue. So this is Darkseid,
okay,
talking to Glorious Godfrey. And by the way, Glorious Godfrey was probably based off of a well-known television evangelist back then. And if you look at his drawings, you can probably figure out who it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
But he was Darkseid's this embodiment of evil and lack of free will and lack of creativity and ultimate control. And he's using this evangelist to spread his ideology on Earth. But anyway, he's commenting to Glorious Godfrey, and he says, "I like you, Glorious Godfrey. You're a shallow, precious child, the revelationist. Happy with the sweeping sound of words, but I am the revelation, the tiger force at the core of all things."
That's amazing.
And there's another, like, later on, it says something to the effect of, like, when children, like, you know, wake from nightmares and, you know, and cry out in their sleep, it is me that they see, you know, and you're like,
that's
what the heck, man.
Dude, it's crazy because, and like, this is why I fell in love with this stuff, because it is like, it's this perfect mix of like sci-fi writing and like fucking punk lyrics, like yeah. Tiger Force. Like, that sounds like it sounds like Iggy Pop lyrics. It sounds like, you know, it sounds like I'm a street walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. Like, that could be like right out of that, you know, like, it's so good. And like, I there's so much, like, people shit on Kirby's writing a lot. Like, that is something that, like, you know, like, it's like kind of like thrown up there with like, oh, comics are can be like kind of poorly, and there is plenty of like poorly written Jack Kirby comics, but none of that matters, because this dude created this like giant body of work that I think might be some of the most tapped into stuff that's ever been published in mass media and whatnot. And it's one of those things, the one thing I wanted to touch on with you that's always kind of like been one of those paradoxes or those dualities that like bugs me for some reason, but like, I get it. Since Kirby was of that era where this is a mass production means and like money and sales are a big part of what shows success and what shows the validity of ideas, let's say, these books he started putting out with DC, they flopped and like they did not sell well, and they were essentially canceled in short order, and like what he was originally doing was all cut off. And like,
yeah.
Speaking as a creative who doesn't really have to worry about those type of things, if someone told me to just stop working on something that I was like, for lack of a better word, channeling from somewhere, and like, and I'd be, it's the worst case of like blue balls you could ever imagine, for lack of better words, you know, like, I can't imagine being in his situation. But even before he got cut off there, it seemed like he really internalized the fact that sales weren't going well, and that like really affected the way that he, like, in the later issues, he kind of, you can tell they're not what those first couple issues were, where the enthusiasm's dropping and whatnot, and like he revisits it and reties it all together in these beautiful stories in a couple, what is it, like 10 years later or maybe even longer afterwards, right? Like he gets to tie it all up. But man, what if he could have finished it all then? Like, what if like, what if he didn't let the sales numbers impact, like, you know, his actual work, and like he kept keep that enthusiasm up, you know? And not that's hard, like, not that he should have been able to, but do you ever think about that? Like, man, what would it have been like?
Well, and you're absolutely right, because, you know, he you know, there's plenty of interviews where he's like, I had to make sales. You know, I have a family I had to take care of. Like,
that was I have to feed my family. That is what he said every time. He's like, this is not. And it's so, man, it's one of those things that I think everybody still struggles with. That's a paid creative, where like there's always doing things creative. You feel weird because you have this thing that you've cultivated and that does feel really good. And when you have to do a version of that specifically for commerce, you're like, oh, that's weird. But for someone like Kirby, where that was always a part of it, that I think it was even, it was probably even harder for him to ever vocalize or to ever like be able to really kind of heal that dichotomy or that rift internally, you know?
Well, you know, and I would take that back to we were talking about Rick Rubin earlier too, where, you know, the New Gods, Fourth World, are these incredible things. And, you know, I don't think the world was ready for them. One.
Yeah, no, you're right.
I don't, you know, the average person that was walking up to a spinner rack in their grocery store was probably not really capable of digesting what was going on in them beyond, like, you know, a very classical mythology where, you know, a father and son are fighting each other over the fate of the universe. That
exactly,
these, you know, ethereal beings manifested. You know, and of course he always had these ideas and flirted with them and other things, and you see a lot of it in Fantastic Four and things like that. But I think, you know, let's pick Jack Kirby out of the past and bring him to now. I think he would have had an audience that was older and would have been like eating this stuff up, you know.
Absolutely.
But, you know, you've got a man who's transcended his genre, but the genre has not been transcended of its audience at that time. And so you run into these, like, the problems, and it happened to him multiple times where they would let him do what he wanted and then it wouldn't really land. And so they would make him start adding in like guest appearances. And, Tom's got a great video on one of the Last Forever People issues where Dead Man is in it.
Yeah. And,
Dead Man was a Neil Adams character about Boston Brand, who was a trapeze artist that died, and his ghost could inhabit other people temporarily and like take over their bodies. And he had to do good while he was doing that to make up for his, you know, seedy life or something like that.
Wild.
But anyway, he didn't want to use Dead Man.
No, and sure not.
They kind of made him use Dead Man. And, you know, it's like he's see some of the enthusiasm leave the page. But, you know, there are two things kind of with Kirby that are connected to this is one, you know, the Fourth World was initially supposed to be its own self-contained reality.
Yeah.
But the first title they really gave him at DC was Jimmy Olsen, Superman's Past. Yes. And so a lot of the fourth world ideas start being brought up in Jimmy Olsen. And so that kind of ties it into the greater DC narrative. And then when he gets to Marvel later, you know, he goes back and tries to do the Eternals, which are sort of a flip on the New Gods in a way. Mm-hmm. If the New Gods are the top down, the Eternals are sort of a bottom up view of these characters inspired the idea of gods and mythology or whatever, a little bit more ancient aliens approach. But that had also been created as its own self-contained universe. And then sales weren't what they wanted them to be. And so the Incredible Hulk shows up, you know, and then like, it just derides the whole like
absolute
feel and vibe and, it's one of those like getting hit over the back of the head,
and he just constantly receives these blows. That's such a bummer. Where like he's obviously created, like it's just it's insane that like after his you know, historic record, that he wasn't allowed to just create whatever he wanted to create and do whatever he wanted to do. Sales be damned. Like, just let the dude go. Like, he's going to stumble upon gold. And like, I don't know. It's just such a different type of, or different way of looking at things, and a different world that I think, again, if we pulled him out and put him into today, like, and he was publishing those stories, I think it'd be a whole different thing. Even if just the way that they were distributed were different, even if those fourth world stories were like self-published through head shops, like the underground comics of the 60s, they would have found a whole different market that would have gotten it in a different way. Like, you give those books to a bunch of people doing acid and mushrooms and getting stoned for the first time. Yeah. They're going to find some stuff in there.
They would have loved it.
Yeah. It's so true. But he's definitely ahead of his time on that one.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, I've got the Treasury edition of 2001, A Space Odyssey over there. And Treasury editions for listeners are like blown up versions of a comic that are like the size of the original art. And Jack is, of course, known for his splash pages. And then the splash pages of sort of him interpreting Kubrick's visual vocabulary through his own sort of, you know, just incredible energy and vastness is unreal in those. It's awesome.
Like, it's so true.
I bought two copies of this book, and they're always, they cost too much money for this. And this is why I've never done it. But I bought them with the intent of like taking the pages out and framing them, because they're poster size in the splash pages, and they're just unreal, you know?
So good.
Oh yeah.
It's the type of thing, if people haven't, I mean, I'm pretty sure anyone listening to this is a fan of Kirby's work, but if you're not, like, don't worry about reading anything. Just go take a look at his splash pages for a couple hours, and you'll find, like, what I mentioned before as far as, like, Kirby being able to kill issue ones, one of the reasons is those splash pages. Like, most of those books start, it's like single splash, double splash, single splash, single splash, and then you're into sequential stuff. Like, there's, like, five splash pages right there, and that's what I want. Like, that's what I want from like an action, like very moving book, is like, give me those big pictures and give me those, like, I don't know, there's something to starting it out with just getting like hit over the head with those things that's so special. And
I've always tried to come up with words to describe that, and I really try not to use bombastic, because I almost did a second ago, because, you know, bombastic sort of implies like a certain like shallowness, and there's not that. But you know, if we call it awesome or dynamic or any of these things, it just, it falls short of the scale and the grandeur of what he's putting out there. And
absolutely,
there is more motion in like perspective and movement in his splash pages of these still figures that are rendered flat.
Than
you would ever see in a 3D movie now. I mean, it's incredible. But he knew how to, you know, create imagery with his heavy line work where this motion is implicit. You know, the characters are dynamic and moving, and then they look like a statue at the same time. Like, they look like they have so much weight behind them.
No, absolutely. If you look at some of his contemporaries, like, look at a Ditko page, and it's stiff as stiff can be in this beautiful way. Like, I love it. It's like one of my favorite aesthetics, but like, Kirby had this way of making these fluid motions come to life. And the way that, like, one of the things that I think is really important about like Kirby's work, like, especially for, you know, comics masters, when you look at people, like, the first time you look at, like, you know, an EC dude, like a Johnny Craig or a Bernie Wrightstein or like any of these people, like, you're like, I can't do that. Like, this is impossible. You look at a Kirby and you know it's like really good, and you, like, as soon as you try and do it, you realize how hard it is. But there's something that looks doable about it. There's something that looks like almost folk artish, or like something that looks very, and like, one of the things that I love that he especially with those splash pages, is he just disregards things like perspective. Like, there will be five different perspectives going on in the same piece that all work for those individual parts. But if you tried to map out the whole perspective, it's not there. Like, he's not using three-point perspective. He's doing what works and what's dynamic. And I think that adds to the dynamism of the whole thing and, like, makes it something that, like, you can't learn that. Get there by doing thousands of pages and, like, having three careers before getting to Fantastic Four and like all of that. Like, it's literally just like this time at that table that's so magical and so cool. I don't know. I love it.
Oh, you know, so I've been like dabbling in music theory a little bit lately, and I mean very much dabbling. So don't let me like insult anybody. Don't take this, you know, as too much of anything but my own naiveness. But, you know, you take something like Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, we all know the song. It's like 20 songs in one that don't fit. There's stuff that happens in the background that, you know, they're like, oh, this isn't an 8/16th beat and this isn't a 3. What? You know, like none of this should happen.
Totally.
And if it did, it should sound like it's awful. and instead, it's like, oh my God, this is awesome. This is unreal, you know?
Yes, yes.
And that's the best way I think I can break Kirby's like splash pages down is, you know, taking what you're saying, because none of these elements look like they should fit together, and they shouldn't if, you know, us mortals tried to do it.
Totally.
But Kirby, like, it comes out like, you know, like, oh my God.
Even the way he would use the collage elements and stuff, there had been people that had done things like that in comics in the past and things, but usually it was like a deadline shortcut. Like, they would take a photo set, a high contrast photo of a skyline or of a building, and like, you know, that way they don't have to draw a background. Kirby took that idea and made it an art form. Like, it's crazy, like, what he did with collages and things like that. Like, he's innovative upon innovative upon innovative, you know? Like, it's just wild. And, like, I think that it was recognized at the time when you read, like, all the way through his career, that was recognized from the times that he was with Simon and Kirby Studio, all the way up through his latest work at Marvel and DC and everything. Even like at DC, it's one of the things he complained about is they would be like, oh, we'll just get Kirby to come up with a new thing. And like, you know, like the Demon's a great example where they're like, all right, we need a horror line. Kirby, give us a horror character. And he just stole the Demon from a Prince Valiant comic and like, literally made it in his own. And he did that as kind of like a fuck you for asking for so much and not compensating me for this, essentially. Right. Like, you know, he never directly said that, but that seems to be the message he was trying to portray, is like, all right, if you think I can just shit this stuff out, here you go. And like, but even when he was just trying to like get it done, he still makes this beautiful thing that, I mean, the Demon is one of my favorite obscure characters, you know, being used by like Alan Moore and stuff to such beautiful ends later on.
I think, you know, and as you and I get older, you know, people will really understand that I think Jack Kirby was the most punk artist that has ever lived. I mean,
so true.
Because of his accessibility, because, you know, of being in a trash medium, and the way he would tell stories without insecurity in there. I mean, it's just like, no, I'm going to embrace what I can do in this liminal format. And there are going to be things that I do here that will never be able to be reproduced anywhere else.
Exactly. Oh man. I don't think that's said enough. That's beautiful. I don't think I've ever heard someone put it like that. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, Super Inframan.
Well, but look, sir, I stole part of that real quick from Frank Miller, who made a comment about how he wanted to make his comics cinematic for the longest time. And it wasn't till he got to things like Sin City where he realized, actually, I can do things in comics that are better than cinema.
Yeah.
And, you know, it changed the way he approached it. But I was like, oh, that explains Jack so well.
It does. And like that, it's so true. Like, it's still why I think this medium is so special. And like, this is, I don't even think I started this episode this way, but I will in the actual introduction. But this is the first of a series that I'm recording on comic books that I'm really excited to do. And I'm having people like yourself and other past guests that I've had on before. And I'm having new guests. Like later this week, I'm talking to Dr. Jeff Kripal, which I'm real excited about.
Oh,
and like,
oh my God. Yeah, yes.
Can't wait. Like, I have so, Mutants and Mystics is one of those books that as soon as I first heard Dr. Kripal on, I guess it probably was, no, it had to be Mike Clellan's podcast where they did a whole episode about Mutants and Mystics a long time ago. And as soon as I heard that, I ordered that book because I was like, that sounds like the book I need to read right now.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I've read a bunch of his other books since, but that book's still like something really special about it. And I'm very excited, but I've also been inviting on a lot of actual cartoonists. And I think I told you, I reached out to Tom Scioli. I'm really excited about Ron Rigi, who I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but it's one of my favorite like alternative artists. He works with Fantagraphics and a bunch of other, but I'm kind of reaching out to span. Cause like anybody that I've heard talk about weird comics, I want to talk to more about this stuff and just kind of get like drilled down, because I think there's something special about the medium of comics and the way it allows for these connections to, as Jack Kirby would say, the source. Like, it allows for a very specific connection to that special place that I do think is related to, whether it's psychedelics or religious experience or mystic experiences. And it's funny, I've been thinking a lot, you know, both of us are pretty involved in the paranormal community.
Yeah.
And it's becoming more prevalent than ever to hear people relate things like psychedelics and spiritual things to the paranormal experiences, like UFOs and, you know, psi abilities and ghosts and all of these things, right? Like, it's starting to become not old hat, but like a little more common for people to talk about how there are similarities between psychedelics. I don't hear creativity being brought up nearly as much as I think it should be in that same category, because I think it has just as much to do with the paranormal phenomenon or the anomalous experiences as psychedelics or religion and everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how can I talk about people? Can I talk to people about things like this? Oh, comics. That's like the weirdest art form there is, and a way that I can kind of like make a little narrative throughout these episodes. So
you know, just to add to that, Todd, like, you know, I fundamentally believe that we are geared to think in story. You know, I think that's how our brain is wired, you know, going back to like our earliest like cave paintings and things like that, you know. And so I think there's a part of us that really can't separate from that. And I also think that's why sometimes high strangeness can be so bizarre, because it doesn't follow a narrative.
And you're right.
You know, it's offsetting to us in a way. And with Jack and that connection to creativity, you know, I know you've heard Chris Ernst talk about this, where he'll maintain that, you know, all musicians are really shamans. Mm-hmm. And I think Jack got to sit with, you know, the creative source so much that he got to know it as, you know, almost, I'm trying to think of the right word. You know, when I did my ketamine experience, I saw creativity flowing through him, through like a point in his body and expanding out. But it was like something he sat with and got to know, you know, as an individual ego examining something bigger than himself.
Yes.
But I think, you know, from the bits that he's talked about it, that he felt compelled to articulate it some, because he had set with it and beside it so much at his art desk, like we've talked about today. The last time, you know, I had two experiences, one where what I met during my ketamine infusion presented itself as Jack. The second time was not Jack, but something that wanted to look like Jack to me. And it was a much more, if you follow me on Instagram, I shared some art of Jack from not too long ago where he played essentially God.
Yeah.
And so this image of Jack, but filled with stars, is talking to me, and we're walking side by side, not standing on anything because we're in the cosmos, but we're walking side by side. And I'm trying not to say he turns to me, but Jack turned to me, this version of Jack, this thing that was looking like Jack, goes, you know, if you want to relate to us like this, you can. And it was, you know, sort of this invitation, like, if you want to use the source and all these things as a paradigm for yourself, like, kind of like you already do that. And I have a Mother Box tattoo on my side. You and I have talked about that before. But it was really interesting. To have this like Starfield version of Jack, you know, standing beside me going, hey, you know, if this is what you want to do, like, do it.
That's beautiful.
It was cool, man.
That's so really cool. I love, well, that it's so perfect because that was going to be the next thing I got. Okay. I wanted to get to was some of the ketamine experiences and some of your, you know, your relationship with Kirby outside of the comics. And like, that's so, so perfect because it really, whatever gets you there, you know, it's funny because it really is. And like these access points to realizing whether it's that we're all connected to something or there's like a bigger thing going on, just those cracks in reality, they can come from anywhere. And it might be best to come from somewhere like Kirby. Like it really, like I've like used the word shaman a minute ago in regards to, you know, people like musicians and stuff. And I don't think, you know, Kirby would have ever even thought of the word before to apply to himself. But it is like what he has put out there is shamanistic work that allows for those bits of light to shine through the cracks of reality and be like, whoa, there is something to the source. And like the source can be a million different things. It can be phrased a million different ways. And like, I love when people find the phrasing that works for them. There's an artist I love named Ramin Nazer, and he has this saying that I'm going to kind of butcher, but essentially it's that like, it doesn't matter if you're re-saying something that's been said before, because the way you're saying it might click with one person in a way that it never has before. So re-say it and say it again in a different way and keep re-saying it, because it's going to be that crack in reality for one person. And I love that Kirby is yours because it's been one for me as well. And I think, I don't know, it's just a perfect, this was exactly how I wanted to start this series, was with somebody that I knew you were very knowledgeable on the subject, but also had a very, because like I said, I'm kind of going out of my comfort zone, reaching out to some cartoonists and stuff, where I'm like, I don't know how on the weird scale some of these folks are, but we're going to see. But I love that this has been a theme throughout all of the people I've connected with in the paranormal is their love for comics. And like, I'm really excited to talk to friends and new people and current creators and people that come at it from an academic point of view, like Dr. Jeffrey Kripal, and see exactly everyone's different take on this stuff. Because I think there's like, there's just something really special about the medium, and it really is connected to the weirdness that we all love so much.
Oh, for sure. You know, and we talk a lot about comics being liminal, but the other thing is, you know, comics are an occult medium. And I mean that in the most like awesome, cool way possible, you know, not in the D&D
totally,
you know, satanic panic from back in the day, but you know, think about, I got exposed to like, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity in Fantastic Four when I was like 4 or 5 years old. You know,
totally.
I just thought everybody knew about that because it was in a comic. You know, and oh my gosh, you know, Atlantis, Lemuria, even like, you know, different views on Theosophist thought and all these things, which, you know, it's very problematic. There's some real problems there, but that's sure, for another thing. Yeah. You know, these ideas made their way into the zeitgeist, and the places that you saw them used in stories were comics. And in comics, you can take that back a step further to look at the pulps, where, you know, you've got people like Lovecraft and Howard and all these guys. I love thinking about the Shaver Mysteries and Ray Palmer, that was the editor of, I forget which pulp magazine that was, but the Shaver Mysteries were about, you know, a secret underground advanced civilization lived in Mount Shasta.
Yep.
And Ray Palmer, who was the editor, you know, was like, these could be true, they could not be true. I'm going to let you decide.
Yes.
But his name got reused for the Atom, you know, the superhero from the Silver Age.
There's so much great ties to that stuff. Yeah. And there's so much, not only that stuff, but if you want to get into the really seedy underbelly, you know what kept comics alive for a lot of this stuff was adult material. Like a lot of these publishers were also publishing pornography straight up and like using the same from the pulps up through like, I mean, I talk a lot about Fantagraphics, which is one of my favorite current comic publishers. And I think publishes some of the best comics that has ever been made in the world. They wouldn't have existed throughout certain periods of their time without Eros, which is their adult comics publishing side of the company. So like it's all tied up in there and it's all part of the magic. Like it is, it's just like the phenomenon where it prefers to be in that gray area where there's some deniability and some weird stuff going on. And like, I think that's where like there's just so much beautiful creativity that comes out of there and a lot of sad stuff too. There's so many, and luckily Kirby wasn't one of these, but there's so many stories of beautiful cartoonists that became, you know, horrible addicts or drunks or, you know, just died in poverty. Yeah. I mean, Wally Wood is the classic example. Bernie Wrightson, also Bernie another Wrightson, like, big one. That's like, talk about somebody that made special, like, man, made special marks. Like that's what I think about sometimes with these guys, is like the mark making, that like where did this come from? Like it's just next level, man. But thank you so much for doing this. I feel like we're at about an hour and a little over an hour here, and I'm feeling like we're at a good place to wrap it up. But is there anything else you want to leave on as far as your thoughts on Kirby, your relationship, or any last words on Kirby?
You know, so I will say, like, I love that I've gotten to like kind of share this advocacy for Kirby, especially on the weirder side, because, you know, it wasn't something that was thought about as much until, you know, people that are our age that kind of grew up with a certain, you know, exposure and things started realizing and putting out there. And, you know, I had seen, like, you know, Grant Morrison was probably the guy that talked about it, you know, first. And I started connecting that back to ideas that I had gotten from my own art mentor, who was absolutely a mystic, and started seeing all these things come together. And it almost seems like, you know, it wants to permeate out in some way. And I kind of wonder if, because you have the success of things like the MCU and whatever, you know, this is kind of like finding its way behind it a little bit. Like, oh, let me get a little of this, like, creative magic, this touch to you, and see what kind of stories come from you because of it. And so, you know, those are the things that I love. And I think, you know, even though Jack would probably avoid some of the language, not all of it, because you go listen to some of his interviews, you're going to be blown away. He would be happy about that. I think he would be very happy with the way people have taken up and been inspired by the things that he created. I had to take a long time sort of accepting that, because, you know, I don't want to get into the conversation, especially this us wrapping up, about who should get credit and things like that. But I felt like Jack got erased quite a bit, not necessarily maliciously, but some just by virtue of Jack being the creative that he was. But, you know, most people don't know who he is, but we all know characters. All of us know characters that he created or co-created. And kind of looking back on it and realizing that, like, this is a man that wanted to tell good stories, that if he showed up at his house unannounced, he would bring you in and sit you at the table and, you know, visit with you for a while and things like that. Like, those were the things that were important to him. And so I just want to put that out there into the ether of, like, you know, if you're enjoying being creative, like, and you love Jack and you have things that, like, he's clicked for you that has inspired you in a way, like, you know, he would be very happy, I think, to know that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I can't think of a better way to end it. That's absolutely gorgeous. And I couldn't agree more. I think that, there's a lot of things that Jack would have loved to see come to fruition, and what he's and, like, you're right. Like, I feel like I take for granted how much I know as far as, you know, what he was involved in shaping culture and comics and everything else, and the characters he created and all of that. But it needs to be put out there constantly. And not only that, but the amount, like, if you like comics at all, I guarantee you at least half of the creators you like are here because of Jack Kirby. Like, it's either he directly influenced them or he influenced the people that influenced them. Like even if it doesn't look like it at all, it's all in there. Like, he really is like at the base of a lot of it. It's funny because there's few people I think about on a daily basis, and I think Jack Kirby might be one of them. Like, D.D. Ramone's up there. I think about D.D. Ramone probably more than I would ever like to admit to, but Jack Kirby's really in there. Like, when I'm sitting at the drawing table, my mind wanders a lot to the Kirby. So yeah, dude, thank you so much for doing this, Super Inframan. I we could go for another 2 hours easily, I'm sure, but I want to keep this somewhat respectful of people's time. Well, and what
thank you so much. This has been excellent, Todd. I appreciate you doing this with me and letting me be a part of it, man.
No, again, I can't think of a better way to kick off this little series. Chris Ernst has agreed to come back on and talk a little bit. We'll be doing an episode soon. And yeah, it's going to be fun I'm going to bring back a lot of people I've talked to before. And like I said, I think it should be a cool little series. So thanks for kicking it off with me. And yeah, let people know where to find you if you'd like. And
yeah. So, you know, I'm on Instagram under Super Inframan, you know, Saxon Williams, if you want to address me by a more human name. And I hang out on Soraya Askcast, Where Did the Road Go, pretty regularly. I feel like I'm kind of like Chris Ernst and I are sort of a duo of co-hosts to come in and hang out with Soraya and cause trouble and shenanigans. And it makes me very happy that I get to do all of this.
Absolutely. It's always wonderful when I see y'all's names pop up on the Where Did the Road Go feed. So I'm sure people will be looking for you there. But yeah, thank you so much and enjoy your evening. We'll do it again, I'm sure. I'll be hitting you up soon to talk more comics or something else weird at some point here.
Sounds perfect. Thank you, good sir.
No problem. Have a good night, buddy.